I was naked on the United Nations website.
International viewing.
Welcome to The Inner Circle, the podcast bringing you into honest conversations about climate action. Together, we'll talk to business owners, experts, activists, and others who are working on circular economy initiatives on the ground. We'll uncover what we're doing right, where people are going wrong, and what needs to be done to change the system to value people and the planet. Together, we're making the impossible possible. Welcome back to The Inner Circle. My name's Erin Andrews. I'm the founder and executive director of Impact Zero, and I'm so happy to have you back with me this week to talk about all things circular economy. So first things first, we need to address the elephant in the room, which is that we've been gone again for a while, but I am very excited to share that this is like the last time that we're going to go MIA. We are back for good. I'm very excited to share that we actually have a producer on the podcast now. His name is Jason Schwimmer. He is officially with us, and he is basically here to help me help him to make sure that these episodes actually come out every week. He's doing everything from looking for our guests to join us on the podcast to actually booking those guests, helping me make sure that we're going to be having very thoughtful conversations with everybody. He's editing the podcast audio and even posting it on the feed and on our social. So now that we've been able to hire him on the team, I'm very excited to be able to focus on having these conversations and, you know, having some help on the podcast. Because if you've done a podcast before, if you've produced any type of, media, especially on a weekly basis, you know how much work is involved. So I'm very excited that we have Jason on the team. And the reason why we're able to bring Jason on is because we have a very exciting sponsor on the podcast now, and you'll hear a little bit from them in a minute, but RLG, otherwise known as Reverse Logistics Group, has partnered with us to help bring this podcast to life. So those are some very exciting things that have been really significant developments since the last time I released an episode. Another big update is that I'm actually, you know, as I'm doing the Impact Zero executive director thing, I'm also working with a consulting firm in Toronto. So I work with SCV Consulting, and we do a bunch of environmental circular economy consulting for companies that want to improve their sustainability. So we do like GHG inventories, and like I'm specifically helping with like LCAs and circular economy strategies and stuff like that. But that's another big development because, I've been doing that full time and then doing, Impact Zero stuff part time. And so all the fundraising and things that are going on with Impact Zero kind of happen on my evenings and weekends now, which is a lot, but that's why, you know, being able to focus on fundraising enables me to then bring on team members like Jason to help make sure that our programs continue to run smoothly and it's not all dependent on me. And I feel like having these conversations are really important because as much as we talk to business owners about their stuff going on, I think it's great to be able to share even my own journey. I don't really know if I love that word, journey, but to, you know, share the process, we'll say, of, you know, having Impact Zero be what it was back in October 2020 when we started publishing the podcast to now. I think it's kind of fun to document these, you know, waves of evolution, we'll call it. So now we're in the mode of like fundraising, getting resources on the team to be able to actually hire folks to, you know, actually like compensate people for their labor. We've been largely volunteer run for 2 years and that's great, but I'm really excited that we're at the point now of having 3 paid staff on the team, and hopefully growing that very soon to probably 4 or 5. So yeah, that's kind of a fun thing. Something else on the program side of things, if you want to be involved with Impact Zero and like come join our programs, we're still doing our monthly circular business networking. The next one is happening on May 17th at noon. Previous attendees have given us really positive feedback. I host them. It's usually myself and maybe like 15 to 20 other people. We do either, sometimes we've done breakout rooms. Sometimes we all just hang out together and like talk and, you know, introduce each other. And, that takes up a lot of time because we get in conversation, but, those networking events are now happening at midday. So if you want to take your lunch break with us on May 17th and come meet some other folks, you can register for that on LinkedIn. We have it posted. And like the Zoom link is literally in that thing. So if you look up Impact Zero on LinkedIn, you can just register for free. And then you can join us on the 17th on Zoom to meet some cool people. So yeah, I hope to see you there. So this week we have a very exciting guest. So I met this person way back at the World Circular Economy Forum. We were both presenting. They were actually an MC of the entire forum. So they had a busy, 2 or 3 days being like on screen the whole time. I really have enjoyed my time with this person. So I'm very excited to have him on the podcast this week. Full disclosure, we recorded this episode a while ago, but I'm very excited to actually have this one published now. So Chuuk is a Black Franco-Albertan from Calgary. He is passionate about the interactions between health, culture, and the environment. So this passion inspired him to pursue his PhD in medical geography after completing his master's degree in environmental health. He is one of the founding directors for Future Ancestor Services, Inc., and the co-founder of The Poison and The Apple. Chuuk has worked in a variety of industries, including oil and gas, fashion, retail, and academia. He is interested in the multidisciplinary nature of our existence and in exploring new solutions that respond to recurring problems. Chuuk was ranked amongst the top 30 sustainability leaders under 30 by Corporate Knights, the top 30 change-making Albertans under 30 by the Alberta Council for Global Cooperation, and the top 10 young Franco-Albertan leaders by Radio Canada. Chuuk was MEC's ambassador for the outdoors and is an alumni of the first Ocean Bridge cohort, a group of young Canadians leading ocean health and literacy projects across Canada. So Chuuk is a very accomplished person and he is always on the go doing a lot of things. So I'm very grateful that he was very gracious in giving us time to talk about the really important things he's working on. So without further ado, let's get into our conversation with Chuuk Odenigbo. This season of The Inner Circle is sponsored by Reverse Logistics Group, or RLG. Live in 80-plus countries with over 30 years of experience, RLG is a tech-enabled organization that offers tailored recycling and circular economy solutions to meet your needs. RLG puts together convenient solutions that will reduce your environmental impact. RLG gets it. Businesses like yours don't always have the time or the resources to spend thinking about environmental compliance and the health of our planet. RLG is a one-stop solution for compliance, returns, and recycling programs across all Canadian provinces and product categories, including batteries, electronics, and packaging. For example, in Ontario, RLG is collaborating with Circular Materials to help brand owners manage their collection and recycling requirements under the new Blue Box regulation. If you're interested in learning more, contact them at canada@rev-log.com or visit them at www.rev-log.com. That's www.rev-log.com.
Allô, bonjour tout le monde. Je m'appelle Choc Odenebo. Hello, everyone. My name is Choc Odenebo. I guess first and foremost, I'd say I'm Franco-Albertan. I am not from Quebec. I'm actually from Alberta, which shocks and surprises people. I think people are just kind of like, what? There's French in Alberta? Yes, y'all. If you do your research, you'll find that Alberta has the third largest Francophone population outside of Ontario and New Brunswick in Canada, if you exclude Quebec. So, hello and welcome. I mean, anyone who knows Albertans knows being an Albertan is an entire personality trait. And anyone who knows Francophones knows being Francophone is an entire personality trait. So being Franco-Albertan, I'm just there being like, woo, hi.
Do you mind sharing a little bit how you got interested in the work that you're currently doing?
So I'm one of the founding directors of Future Ancestor Services. We are a Black and Indigenous-owned and operated youth-led professional services enterprise based in Calgary, though we do operate Canada-wide. And I don't even know where to start, so I'm going to start way back when. I come from a very nomadic family. My parents both work for the United Nations, so we moved around quite a bit in my childhood. And so as a function of that, it's a function of sort of changing home and changing where I lived every 6 months to a year, depending on country and depending on city. I, from a very young age, for some weird reason, always had sort of esoteric questions as to sort of whether I even exist. There were times now I used to think I was like in a simulation, or that I wasn't real, and I don't know how that came to be, but, you know, I'm going to blame it on a lack of connection to the land. The places that gave me comfort were always nature spaces. My parents were always very big about ensuring that we had, like, a good house, like a backyard where we could, like, run around and play in. And while I was never the most active child, I found pleasure in sitting underneath a tree and reading a book or in downloading a movie and watching it outside. So I'm paraphrasing, but it's something along the lines of, I like putting my hand on a tree trunk, not to confirm that the tree exists, because that I have no doubt, but to confirm my own existence. And so being in those spaces made me feel like I existed. As I sort of grew older and started entering into sort of career spaces, right? It's like, you know, when you hit a certain age, it's like, what are you going to do with the rest of your life? What do you want to study? What do you want to go to university for? It didn't occur to me that I could build a career in the environment, because I'd never seen anyone who looked like me or was like me in another form be in those environmental spaces, right? Because at that time period, environmental spaces or green spaces or outdoor spaces were very white, middle-aged man dominated. And then I wasn't seeing, you know, Black people in nature. I wasn't seeing the kids of immigrants in nature. I wasn't seeing prominent Francophones in nature. And I know Francophones were in nature, right? But I didn't see that. So as a function of not seeing this, as a function of not being aware that this was even an option for me, you know, I struggled in picking what I wanted to study. And so when I started university, I actually ended up taking an environmental science course as an elective because it was the only thing that fit into my schedule. Out of curiosity, Googled what an environmental science major would entail. And it entailed everything. Like, there were courses in religion, the environment, environmental politics, wild law, environmental business, environmental economics, sustainability. It was a spectrum. And that gave me so much joy because I like to consider myself a jack of all trades, a master of none. I thrived in environments where I got to study a spectrum of things. And so that phrase actually ends off with a jack of all trades is a master of none, but that is better than a master of one. The idea of building competency in such a wide variety of subjects and approaches was tantalizing to me. And so I was like, ooh, we are going to jump on that and we are going to get an environmental science degree because I will then be doing hardcore sciences. At the same time, I will be writing philosophy essays. At the same time, I will be having esoteric conversations about society, all as part of this degree. So that was really, really exciting. So that stimulated my intellectual side. But at the same time, I still didn't think I could get a job in the environment because, once again, didn't see people like me in it. And there was then this turning point in my third year of university. And so prior to this, anything I'd seen environmental, I didn't identify with, right? The environmental movement was dominated by like Greenpeace and the WWF and whatnot. And they had messages that were like, you know, stop flying, you know, taking airplanes, like the worst thing you can do for the carbon footprint. And I'm like, well, I have family around the world and I live in the second largest country in the world. And I'm going to university in a province that is 5 hours away by flight from my home province. So no, I will not stop flying. What? That's ridiculous. Because that is such a privileged thing to say. When flights have become accessible for people financially, it then becomes unreasonable to ask people to waste their time, spend 2-3 days in a car to be able to get home, or cut themselves off from family members who live overseas. We're not in Europe, you know, right? We're not like, I'm not like in France and my family is in like Belgium and I get to hop onto a train, right? We are effectively one of the most isolated countries in the world. We don't get to stop flying. That's a harmful message, especially in a country that likes to profess how multicultural we are. We've got a lot of people who are first gen, second gen, third gen. And if you're any of those gens, you have family abroad. Absolutely. Right? And not all of us, and even those who are 10th generation, are not always in the same province as their family. They're not always in a place that has opportunity. So are you telling somebody who is from a small town in northern BC, don't pursue education because don't fly? Oh my God, you know how bad that would be for the environment. Sacrifice yourself for the environment. So that on its own did not, that rubbed me fully the wrong way. There was this perpetuated myth about overpopulation. And overpopulation is a myth that is anchored in racism because it's only really sort of like poor communities who tend to be communities of color. And this can be at a worldwide scale, even at a local scale, who are then criticized for having lots of children. But the irony is these large families use less resources than a 3-person family who is middle or upper class in Canada, right? And so at that point, it's perpetuating this myth of individual responsibility, when in reality, it's a structural societal issue. And there's a whole host of other examples I can give, but all of that to say that just didn't sit right with me, rubbed me the wrong way. I didn't identify with it. So I was like, this is clearly not a movement for me. This is not a space where I am welcome in. And then in my third year of university, I had a professor, I was doing a sustainability course, and my professor was very avant-garde. And so for our final exam, she was like, you have got 2 weeks to change the world and submit proof that you did, or you can do a literature review. And so I was like, okay, challenge, this is exciting. And at that time I was modeling. And so I had a bunch of like model friends and photographer friends. And so I got one of my photographer friends and a couple model friends, and I double checked municipal bylaws, side note. Double checked municipal bylaws and did a Adam and Eve-esque style photo shoot in a park. So basically we were all like naked in this park, while like with like computers and books and, you know, using park benches. And I call this photo series My Green Dream, the idea of reconnecting humanity with nature without losing modernity, right? Without losing all the advancements we've made that have allowed so many people to have good lives, and without sacrificing certain people for the sake of the environment, but to find ways to authentically reconnect and form communities that are in harmony with nature. And I submitted the photo series to the United Nations because that year they were having a Rio Plus 20 conference on sustainable development. And the United Nations like published my photo series on their website. So I was naked on the United Nations website.
International viewing.
I mean, you know, just if only fans was around then, would have had a paywall. And my prof resonated so strongly with the message that I had that she gave me an A+. And I got listed as one of the top 25 in Grantlist under 25. That let me know that my voice was not just something that people wanted, but it was needed in the movement and that there was space for me. And so that's how I got into doing my best to figure out ways in which I can contribute to creating a society that is both connected with nature and in harmony with nature.
There are so many parts of that that we could like go down rabbit holes in. Preachiness without systems for people to use to modern nature connection. I remember you posted on Instagram, you and Larissa, I saw, being like on your phones also in nature. And I was like, yes, we can do that. And that was actually so impactful for me. I was at my parents' house in Kingston, and they live like around a lot of nature. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to go work on my laptop outside by some trees.
Yes.
Your voice and voices like yours are so critical, because if you're not actually factoring in other people's experiences, we're not actually going to be able to make anything significant happen. So with all of that, how does this translate into the work that you do with Future Ancestors? So what does that team do?
So our name is not just a name, it's also a mandate, right? We see ourselves as advocates of the future generation, of people who aren't here yet, whose lives will be impacted by the actions and decisions that we make today. And so there's that piece, trying to build an equitable world for the future. But then also, the other piece is we recognize that we're the future of our ancestors. And so in recognizing that we're the future of our ancestors, we recognize that we receive a lot of strength, wisdom, knowledge, culture, you know, lots of beautiful things from our ancestors. But in that same vein, we also recognize our ancestors made some mistakes. And so it's up to us as their future to fix those errors such that the next generation no longer has to deal with the consequences of those errors. And so our mandate is, how can we make our society and our country better for the next generation of people who will be on this land, whether they are born here or whether they're coming here from immigration? And how can we ensure that life will also be good for the non-human entities on this land? And so all of that can be nicely sort of summarized with the idea of climate justice, the idea of ensuring that the movement for social justice is paired with the movement for the environment, and recognizing that the two are very strongly interlinked. And so I always tell people I was dragged kicking and screaming to justice spaces. So after university, when I finished university, I was able to land a job as an environmental scientist. And I was doing environmental impact assessments, environmental site assessments, which for anyone who doesn't know what those are, effectively an environmental impact assessment is before anyone does any project, you go to the land, you survey, you figure out like the baseline conditions, and then you try and figure out ways in which the project will impact it and try and mitigate those. And environmental site assessment is you go after the project is done and you're like, ooh, what happened? How do we clean this up? And they're both incredibly rewarding work. I find environmental site assessments a lot more rewarding because I get a lot more freedom. In environmental impact assessments, there's a host of really awkward caveats where, you know, you're being paid by the client who is trying to to do the minimum for the benefit of the environment. And so you're kind of like, how do I diplomatically tell you to be better? But in this work that I was doing and in my efforts to, you know, be a great environmental scientist, my Blackness was actively a hindrance. So in Alberta, a lot of people may not realize this, but a lot of oil wells are actually in private land, on farmland especially. And so you have to obviously alert the homeowner or the landowner that you're going to be on the land for whatever company doing whatever it is you're doing. And so I often had to have my white boss come with me to rural areas in Alberta to let them know that a Black person was going to be on their land and request that they do not threaten or shoot me. Which made me feel bad because I was the only person out of the team of environmental scientists who had to be babysat by his boss, who had to have his boss follow him into rural Alberta, driving 3, 4, 5 hours just to make sure that I'm able to do my job. And so as a function of that, plus also being the youngest on the team, because I was 20 when I started working, I ended up getting very abused in that workplace. I worked 60 to 70 hours a week while only being paid for 40, you know, trying to be like the yes man, trying to prove my worth, trying to say, you know, I recognize that y'all are facing difficulties as a function of me being Black. So I'm going to work twice as hard to demonstrate that it was worth hiring me and bringing me on. So that's like one example. Another example is I was doing an ocean. I was learning about the ocean through OceanWise. They put together Ocean Bridge, which is a cohort of 40 young people. At the time, it was 40 young people. Now they've changed it a little bit. By the time it was 40 young people from all across what is County Canada to work on ocean health and ocean literacy issues. And so they brought us to Haida Gwaii to learn from Haida folk, because the Haida live in coordination with the water, as in they believe that they come from the water, the water holds very strong value in their spirituality, in their culture, in their way of being. So, you know, learning traditional knowledge about the water. And so while I'm in Haida Gwaii, actively learning about the ocean and trying to do a service project that's seeking to give back for all the knowledge that we've been given, we were in a bus, and the bus driver, who was hired by OceanWise to drive us around Haida Gwaii, who is from Haida Gwaii, born, raised, lived their entire lives there, heard me speaking French to one of my colleagues who was up there. And she turns around while driving this bus and says to me, "Speak English, we're in Canada. Your French is not welcome here." And then goes on to tell the story about how the Haida were successful in banning French classes from the island in order to be able to have Haida classes, which is a side note, BC is an absolutely tedious place. Like, how is it that to get Indigenous language courses, you have to cancel a different language course? Like, that is on its own is highly problematic, but that's its own side note. But the thing is, like, I wasn't the first person in that bus to speak French. I was the first Black person in that bus to speak French. And so when all my white Francophone friends in that bus were speaking French to each other, she said nothing. Lack of courage, maybe lack of awareness, maybe wasn't paying attention, whatever it was, she said nothing. But the second I opened my mouth, that was when she was like, "Ooh, time to put this Black Francophone in his place." And so no matter what I do in environmental work, no matter what I do for the environment, no matter what, how much I can concentrate on my work for the environment, my race, my identity, these various elements always come into play. And so I realized that I have to work on justice issues. I need to create a just society in order for me to actually be able to dedicate my time, energy, and self to advocating for the environment. And so that is how I was part of founding Future Ancestors Services. I was like, we need a better world, we need a just world, we need just societies. And I'm hoping that through the work that we do in educating organizations and in making society more just, that I will then be able to also, as a consequence of that, focus on environmental work and create equity in environmental spaces.
Yeah, it seems like you almost have to do like this foundation work, which makes a lot of sense, to be able to not just make it easier for like yourself, but to make it easier for, again, the future generations and having that generational mindset around it. And I appreciate you sharing those stories as well to help add some like additional understanding around that. And it's good that we have kind of like across Canada that like this is a thing that exists everywhere, because I think a lot of people are really quick to say like central provinces that are like highly conservative, but I like it's important to recognize that this happens across the country and beyond, obviously, but it's not just a siloed problem. So yeah, thank you for that. So on that note, though, I want to talk a little bit more about what it means to be a Black and Indigenous organization, because obviously that's really core to everything that you do. So just for anyone who's maybe uncertain about that, what does it mean? Like, what's the real like impact of that?
That's something that we are still figuring out as well. We honestly haven't seen organizations like ours. So we don't have a model that we get to sort of like copy paste and modify for ourselves. And so we function within, you know, colonial society. So there's certain things that we have to do because of the law, you know, taxes, things like that. We obviously are not breaking the law in any way, shape, or form. But beyond that, the ways in which we operate, it's up to us to build that. And so there's so many things that we had to sort of unpack, right? So first of all, we had to unpack pan-indigeneity, right? We are a Black Indigenous organization, but Indigenous peoples are a plethora of people, right? It's une société plurielle, comme on dit en français. It's a plurality of people. And so that effectively means that there's various ways of being, doing, existing, beliefs, languages, etc. And so my two co-founders, Larissa Crawford and Samantha Matters, are Métis women. And so we draw a lot from sort of Métis traditions and Métis worldviews, and of course the Michif language in the ways in which our organization operates. But then you also have me and Larissa who are Black. And being Black is not equivalent to being Indigenous. We don't have the same ways of being. We don't have the same perspectives in the world. And being Black is a racial group, whereas being Indigenous is a cultural group. And so Black people are united by shared oppression, whereas Indigenous folk are united by shared worldview, shared culture, shared ways of being, shared histories, and also shared oppression. And so when we were sitting down and trying to figure out what it means to be a Black and Indigenous organization, there are times when our views differed, right? So for example, Larissa and Sam, you know, through Métis teachings, wanted to create a non-hierarchical structure. They were like, you know, Métis societies are not hierarchical. Métis societies don't really have elders. There's no Métis word for elder. And so Métis societies are very sort of like equal, very flat. Whereas Black people as a whole, we really enjoy hierarchies. Like we have a lot of sort of, you know, king and queen rhetoric. You know, we talk about Black queens, we talk about Black kings, we talk about being the king of your household. And we thrive quite a bit well in hierarchies. And so, you know, we were sitting there and I was just like, I refuse to be at the same level as everybody. That is absolutely not the thing. And so we then had to decorticate, dive into, break down, look into. Decorticate. I'm just gonna say decorticate, look it up on the dictionary. So we then had to sort of like decorticate what a hierarchy means to us. And so to me, a hierarchy symbolizes responsibility. The higher up you are, the more responsibility you have towards anybody who is, you know, quote unquote, lower on the hierarchy than you. And so that responsibility in a workplace setting means that I'm looking after their well-being. I will be the person to deal with any clients that are confrontational and negative. I will help them out of any sticky spots if they make a mistake. I'm happy to sort of take that responsibility on and fix that mistake and, you know, fix that relationship with the client. Or take the heat. You know, I'm responsible for ensuring that our workplace is a safe space for them or a brave space, depending on the kind of space that we need. You know, really ensuring that, you know, I take all the responsibility that comes with leadership. And so when we defined it as responsibility, then we were like, we were more comfortable creating a hierarchy where we hierarchize certain things. So for example, the pay is the same for everybody because you do a certain job, you should get the money. It doesn't really matter if you're like a director or, you know, a non-director, like you've done the same job, you've taken the same amount of effort, the same amount of knowledge. It doesn't make sense to have a different pay. But also in addition to that, our pay is public to our team. It's not public to obviously the public, but all our team members know how much everybody gets paid. And so that's not hidden. And so because that's not hidden, we can't have a pay gap. We can't unfairly discriminate against someone financially, right? And so there's no hierarchy in pay. There's no hierarchy in the kind of jobs that you can take on. It's like, if you want to work with a certain client, go for it. You're not going to be like, okay, no, these clients are just reserved for directors and these other clients are for everybody, right? It's so, as a function of that, we are in a way non-hierarchical because we don't have a lot of the hierarchies in place a lot of other organizations do, but we are hierarchical in the sense that we do have directors and we do have people who are not directors, and we do attribute a different sense of responsibility to each role, even if we're not making a distinction in pay, even if we're not making a distinction in the kind of jobs they can do, even if we're not making a distinction in expertise. So there's many other ways in which our identities have manifested in our work. You know, we talk about the concept of well-being, because once again, as being a Black Indigenous workplace, we are constantly being traumatized, fetishized, targeted by society. And so no matter how perfect our workplace is, and I'm not saying it's perfect, but let's say it's a perfect workplace, you know, there's still Black people being killed by police. There are still Indigenous kids, dead kids being found in residential schools all the time. Like, I think one group was found today, right? And so this impacts our well-being, right? It's hard, it's painful to deal with. It's painful to live through. It's painful to open up Twitter and you see someone who looks like they could be an uncle, you know, having their neck being crushed by the policeman. It is painful to have your coworker call you crying, saying, my daughter asked me why all those kids were killed, because it was all over the news, so she's hearing about it, and she's an Indigenous 4-year-old. And so now you have this Indigenous mother trying to figure out, how do I tell my Indigenous 4-year-old about residential schools and why these kids were killed in a way that is acceptable for a 4-year-old, right? And these are things that we have to deal with, that organizations that are not majority Black or Indigenous don't necessarily think about. And so as a function of that, we are trying to design a workplace that is made for healing, right? So we have a go-to traumatologist that our staff members can access. We do vicarious trauma training courses, but then we're also creating policies that seek to create a workspace of healing. So we have a decolonization of time policy that centers our well-being above arbitrary moments of time, arbitrary deadlines, right? There's no point in sacrificing your well-being and your health to get something done by a certain deadline. If your health is in question, always choose your health. Do not sacrifice your health for a deadline that can probably be extended by a week, right? So really sort of like putting in place policies that center health, that center well-being. We also have a company insurance plan to ensure that everybody has health insurance. And in the company insurance plan, we have $1,200 set aside specifically for therapy, right? So most insurance plans, if it's not like dental or whatever, it's like you get $250 for like a podiatrist, $250 for a naturopath, $250 for a chiropractor, whatever. And so $250 for therapy. And we were like, no, we'll cancel a couple of the things that we don't really need to make sure that like therapy is like highlighted. Right, so we have like a plan that's like very much by us for us. We recognize our commitment to community, right? Because Future Ancestors is a social enterprise. And so what a lot of people misunderstand about social enterprises is they think a social enterprise gives a percentage of its earnings to charity, to community, whatever. That's not a social enterprise, because that effectively means that if the enterprise has a bad year, then what they give to community is lower. They're like, oh no, I'm so sorry. We either don't have the money to give to community, or we're just going to cancel it for this year, or whatever. A social enterprise means that we only do well if our communities do well. And so that also means we have policies in place to support our communities. We have, for example, a supporting North policy in recognition that Northern Canada is under a lot of structural barriers that we don't face in Southern Canada. Because even though Canada is one of the most northern countries in the world, right? We like to claim that Santa Claus lives here. We have designed our systems as if we are a southern country. And that is highly problematic, because we're not a southern country. We are absolutely not a southern country. And so we are creating food guides with foods that don't grow above the tree line. We are creating so that they're completely inaccessible, or you have to pay that high premium for the food being shipped up north. We are, you know, we have hospital policies where you have to give birth in a hospital. And Nunavut has one hospital. And so people who are pregnant have to fly 2 weeks before their due date in a tiny plane on their own to give birth alone in a city that they don't live in. Right? Like, you've got all these weird policies that we have in place instead of, for example, pushing midwifery. And ensuring that every community has a series of midwives so people can have home births, and the only births you're sending to the hospital, the complicated ones, right? We need to like have food guides that also sort of like have a northern version, right? It's like, okay, according to like, you know, Good Nutrition, apparently it turns out that this animal and that blubber and this, excellent stuff for the health. And then if you couple that with like Inuit tea, phenomenal for the health. You know what I mean? Like, so really creating a country that recognizes who we are instead of trying to copy-paste southern countries and their ways of being and their ways of doing. So we have a northern support guide. And that northern support guide effectively means that whenever we need something as an organization, whether it is we need merchandise, we need stationery, we need to plan a company retreat, whatever it is, we will prioritize any businesses that are based in the North, or we'll prioritize going to the North for any of these sort of retreats so that we make sure that our money is being spent in the North, because they don't get enough of that. So all of that to say, we're still working out what it means to be a Black Indigenous company, but to us it means ensuring that we're centering community and putting in place policies that systematically ensure that communities benefit from our existence. Our profit is communities' profit is our profit. That we center our identities, and so in recognizing we're Black and Indigenous, and that we have a team of racialized folk who are Asian and whatnot, we need to find ways to ensure that people feel respected in our space, people feel like our workspace is a space of healing, not just a space of, oh, I need to make money, but a space of, okay, now that I'm in the workplace with my coworkers, I feel like I'm being healed. from the harsh realities of the world around us. And it means centering our identities in our structure. You know, what do Métis teachings tell us about doing business and being in commune with one another? What does Blackness mean within the context of an economy? But then also, what does being Francophone mean in the context of a business, especially Francophone from outside of Quebec? How do we center, you know, the Métis language when it doesn't hold economic value, right? We're not going to have a client who's going to reach out to us and say, hey, we want this training in Mischief. But we still want to make sure that we build capacity in Mischief. So how do we do that in a way that gives language economic value? So all of these different things are questions that we're still asking ourselves and we're slowly growing on. But effectively, yeah, that's what it means to be a Black Indigenous organization.
So when I was doing Impact Zero setup, we were trying to ask ourselves, like, what does it mean to like decolonize like a nonprofit, you know, because it is inherently a colonial construct. So it's hard to work within like the legal requirements and find ways to like, you know, weave in whatever like considerations you need to have. And like what you say, like the systemic things, like the policies or the hierarchy, I think is really interesting too, because we kind of grappled with that of like doing a flat structure, but then like, does it actually, like, would it actually work for our purposes and with the people that we work with? And I'm happy that you walked us through that process of like, the pay is flat. There are certain things that will need to be structured in a certain way, but like also completely different because you've been very intentional about how you design it. So I think that's like good inspiration for anyone listening to think about, like, whether you're like a startup person or if you're working within a company, like how can you like weave in these things to make these spaces more like not even just inclusive, but honestly just like safer for everybody, you know, like not even with the intention of being like, oh, we want to have like an IND initiative. Like it's just to be a better space for humans that exist within your space. So I'm curious to know your thoughts about why organizations like Future Ancestor Services are so critical.
So I think organizations like Future Ancestors Services are important for a plethora of reasons. The first reason is to show how to not tokenize diversity, right? Because we, as a Black Indigenous company, I think a lot of people assume that Black Indigenous just means that we have Black and Indigenous people. And that's not necessarily true because we have a lot of people who aren't Black or Indigenous. That speaks more to company culture, that speaks more to the systems that we have in place than it does to the people who work at the organization. We could be entirely staffed by white people and we'd still be a Black and Indigenous company. So we're hoping that our very existence teaches people how to not tokenize, but really sort of embrace what it means to be in a multicultural society. Multicultural means various cultures, various ways of being, various worldviews, and using those worldviews to inform how you operate. Because the way we operate as a society has so strongly been informed by colonial ideology that to decolonize means to sort of say, okay, we have employees from here, 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 and here. And they could all be from, let's say, Toronto. They could literally all be from Toronto, but of various descents, various backgrounds, various ways of being. And it's like, you know, how does your family function? How do you operate? How do you do this? Take the best of each practice and implement it systemically into the organization, because that on its own is going to make the organization a lot more successful. It's also going to make people a lot happier in the organization, which means that you're going to lose less people. You're going to attract more people. We get dozens of emails and LinkedIn messages of people wanting to like work for us. And, you know, while we appreciate it, we're not hiring. But that happens literally as a function of being a workspace that people want to be in. So that is sort of that piece. But then the other piece is the services that we offer, right? So as I mentioned, we offer a wide variety of services. The services that are most known for are our anti-racism trainings, but we offer a host of services. I mean, I've done health impact assessments for food security in a First Nation. We've done design work for a foundation that integrates concepts of anti-racism into the design of the report that they wanted to put together. We've done decolonization training, environmental justice training. We've helped organizations write policies. And so basically our existence is to say that you are not alone, right? a lot of people have a tendency of saying, oh, go to your research. But it's like, if you don't really know what to Google, you're gonna not Google the right thing. You're gonna end up on, you know, the wrong side of the internet. Things will go down this awkward spiral. You're gonna be that person who's like, oh, we've put in place this like measure that requires 30% of our employees be like people of color. That's not a good policy. I'm just gonna say that right now. Not a good policy. And so organizations like ours let you know that you're not alone. You get to hire an expert to come in and to sit down with you and say to you, okay, what are your goals? And then tell you straight up, actually, those goals are not good enough. Let's make your goals better. And now that we've got good goals, let's figure out how we're going to get there. What do we need to learn? What do we need to have in place? What do we need to change? And what should we keep the same? And then from there, you have a pathway, you have a map, you have a way to move forward. You're not sort of blindly sort of struggling on your own, trying to figure it out. And that brings me to point number three, bringing together a sense of community, right? We've always sort of divided business from community, right? Before, business used to be integrating community. You know, we talk about like the importance of like, I'm going to say corner store. In French, we call it dépanneur. I don't know what it's called in English anymore. Is it called corner store or convenience store?
Either or.
Okay, perfect. Right, we talk about how those are important for communities and how like you walk into like your little like a local corner store and like you tend to know the person there because you see them all the time and they're like, hey, and you're like, hey, and you know, it's whatever. But other than that, we started separating business from community. Now that we have sort of these large multinational conglomerates, we've got Walmart, we've got Costco, we've got, you know, Amazon. And some of them are not bad, right? Like Costco is very well known for treating its employees well and for having good job security and for having great upward movement. So they don't, you know, it's not that they're necessarily negative enterprises, but it's almost like we've gotten these organizations at the sacrifice of smaller organizations, smaller local organizations that let you sort of be in touch with community. And so organizations like ours help remind you of the feeling of community, because the way we work with you is we want to get to know you. And we want to get to know you not just as an organization, but as an individual, like the person we're working with, we want to get to know. I want to know your hobbies, I want to know your interests, I want to know if you have kids, you know? And so I think that also changes people's perception of work, because I've literally had clients tell me, oh my God, that was such a fun meeting. And we spend the entire meeting talking about like how to like dismantle racism in the organization. And they'll be like, that was such a fun meeting. I really enjoyed it. Oh my God, I've been looking forward to this meeting, right? Because, you know, we try and create spaces of community when we work with folk. So our existence is important for basically two major reasons. Major reason number one, the services we provide, I think, are needed, and I think they're very useful, and I think they're effectively critical. But then B, we're also needed because just by looking at the way we function, you can reevaluate the way that you function and see what really is and is not necessary. I think there's a lot of things that we sort of assume, okay, because this is the norm, this is required, that when we actually sort of like question, we're like, actually, there's no law that says that, like, you know, the president has to be paid more than the employee. There's no law that says that, like, the mid-level management gets to have more vacation breaks than, like, the person that the intern we just hired. There's none of that. So we question that. There's, you know, why is it taboo to talk about money in a workplace where you're there literally for the money? Like, why is that taboo? Like, why can't I know what your paycheck is? Why can't I use your paycheck to inform how much I should like demand from HR? But then at the same time, it's also like, why should I have to demand money? Like, shouldn't it just be sort of like an automatic given? That was a very like anticlimactic end, but yeah.
I was thinking kind of as you were speaking about like the 30% like POC people in workplaces, it's like, it kind of, that's like a really great representation of what we were saying before, how like you can't ask things of people if you don't build the systems to like act, it'll just, you'll get more than 30% if you just make inclusive policies and like change how you operate. I think that that's so critical. And obviously the fact that you guys are helping people do that is really important, because the impact that you're having on people's lives, that just like, you know, the ripple effect of your work is probably massive. And I'm sure that's really nice to see. Hopefully, if you don't always think about it, this is your reminder to think of the ripple effect that your work has.
It is the ripple effect that gets us through, because like people, I think, keep forgetting there's easier ways to make money than like entering the spaces where you may not fully be respected. Like we enter into spaces where we've literally had someone be like, white men are the most discriminated people in our workplace. And I'm like, are they? Please tell me how a workplace that's majority white men is discriminated against. They're like, well, they're not allowed to speak their mind. I'm like, oh my God, that's so hard. So, you know, there are easier ways to make money. I think people keep forgetting there's easier ways to make money. And so what keeps us going is that ripple effect. This whole idea that, you know, we are where we are as a function of the various people who've come into our lives. And so we want to come into the lives of others and hoping that we're able to have them get to better places and, you know, be a part of their story and hopefully a positive part of their story.
I think that that is all that we have time for, but I would also love to give you an opportunity to share where people can find you, like your website, email, but don't email Chuuk for jobs. They don't have jobs. But, you know, all the places where people can learn more.
Absolutely. So our website is futureancestors.ca. Our Instagram and Twitter accounts, which are our most sort of active social media, are @ancestorsfuture. And then, you know, feel free to, if you would like to hire us, feel free to hit us up at info@futureancestors.ca. If you want to hire me specifically, hit me up at chuuk@futureancestors.ca. And if you are actively looking for a job, while Future Ancestors may not be hiring, hopefully I will forward your CV along to people who are great. Maybe I'll forward your CV to Erin and be like, you know, Impact Zero. So feel free to touch base and I will see what I can do within reason.
Amazing. You're so generous, as always. Okay, yeah. Thank you so much, Chuuk. It's been great chatting. And I'll see you whenever.
À la prochaine, comme on dit en français.
Thank you so much for joining us on this week's episode of The Inner Circle. If you'd like to learn more about the foundation, you can visit our website at impactzero.ca. You can also find us on Instagram @impactzero.ca and as well on LinkedIn, Impact Zero Foundation. Thanks again for hanging out with us today, and we'll see you next week.